Jeff Seymour, and welcome to the podcast. Today, I'm going to talk about the type of information you need if you really want to own your scene. I'll explain. I use the word ownership frequently. You know, I say, you've really got to own your words. You've got to own your argument. You know, you've got to own your point of view. And I think, certainly on its surface, it is easy to understand. Anyone who understands English could understand that concept. It sounds good. It makes sense. Yeah, I want to own. I want to own. Own sounds good. That seems complete. That seems like I've really got my arms around it. It's mine. I get it. That feels, you know, like I'm really on a quest to be authentic because I want to own the things that I discuss. But how do we own? How do we get to that? How do we get to this point where we feel like we really own the problem, which is always the heart of the matter? To own our point of view, our dilemma. How do we own it? One of the biggest obstacles that we face when we're acting and we're breaking down scenes or trying to get, you know, understand our character and, you know, do the work that's asked for us in a scene, is trying to find that point of view. What is that thing they're looking for? Where's the drama here? I'm obviously upset, so, and I can see the letters here, they're all capitals. I'm clearly yelling, and I can read the thing and understand why I'm upset. It makes sense. Okay, so yeah. But how do we actually get our hands on that idea to the point that we feel like it's our idea? It's our thing. Doesn't it make sense that if somehow magically we could not only identify what the core issue is, the problem, the dilemma, you know, really understand what our particular character is going through, what they're needing to do, whatever that is. If somehow we could not only understand that intellectually, but we could actually make it a part of our own problem. That is what I think our quest is, as actors of the 21st century, of this kind of ultra-realism, the real stuff, where we don't even see your acting anymore. I mean, really, if you think about it, if there was a way that you could, in fact, own that dilemma, like it's all of a sudden, some magically, it's your dilemma, then really, if you pursued the lines in your scene and you understood everything, it would seem to me you'd have your best chance of delivering that kind of authentic, needed performance for the sake of the story, the needed element you would add. You would be able to do that. You'd be able to pull that off in some magical, beautiful way. But it brings us back to this issue of, well, how do we really latch on to something? You know, I just had a student of mine in Australia send me a message after one of the online teaching courses we did, and he'd made some improvement. He was very happy about it. And he said, but you know, where I was yelling at you, I mean, I understood that's what I should be doing, and it made sense to me that I was doing it, but if I was going to be honest, I wasn't really angry at you. Right. Yeah, this kind of top drawer acting that I'm always aspiring to and thinking is just the most magnificently magnetic is a bit of a slippery fish, you know. It is something that takes a lot of understanding, you know, empathy, and then a finesse. Because ultimately, in answering his question, yeah, ultimately what you would like is between action and cut to actually be mad at me. To actually, when we say cut, go, wow, sorry, man, I got a little pissed at you right there. I really did. That would be the tricky thing, right? Which brings us back again to, so how do we own it? So I want to use an example because I did a coaching session with someone. It's the online training that I do. I do the scenes, obviously, with the actor. And then I ask them questions, like I ask questions of the students in the classes, you know, saying, you know, why is this? How was that? How did that happen? The things that I think tend to make it more easy for the actor to own the problem. Because it's one thing to understand it intellectually, and it's another one to get it. And I know when actors get it. I'm watching them, and then I look at them, and they go, oh, I get it. And then they got it. So I'm going to use this example. I like this particular one because it kind of addresses one particular, a few issues, but, one. It's from The Savages, the movie. And I believe this scene was between brother and sister, and I think it was Philip Seymour Hoffman and Laura Linney, if I'm not mistaken. I like to use this scene because the brother, who is obviously an intellectual, they're both intellectuals, is questioning his sister about whether or not she, in fact, did get accepted and given a Guggenheim grant. At the top of the scene, he says, look, I saw the list in the paper, the fellows for the year, your name wasn't there. She says, wow, that's crazy, must be a oversight. He says, it wasn't. She says, what? He said, an oversight. He says, how do you know? He said, because I have a friend that works down there. And, I called because, I wanted to see, but, if they'd made a mistake. And she accused him, no, you didn't. You were policing me. That's sick. And she starts getting very angry about it. And then he keeps grilling her. And he says, did you get the Guggenheim? What about it? You didn't get it. I called him up, my buddy, I found a guy who works there. He says, you've been turned down 8 times. And she says, how many times you've been turned down? He says, 6. That's not the point. She said, it is a point. Then she goes on to talk about how, dad, their dad and him, the person she's talking to, never really believed in her, never really thought she could do it. So he finally just cuts to it and said, where did you get the money? And she says, I got a grant. You quit lying. He says, okay, it wasn't a Guggenheim. All right, big effing deal. It was another grant. Who cares? And then he says, what? And then she says, FEMA. And he says, FEMA, what are you, FEMA? I don't know FEMA. What, federal emergency? She says, yeah. He said, well, how were you affected? It was 9/11. So, well, everyone was affected. Everyone in the world, but you don't go stealing money. She says, I'm not stealing money. I got a grant. And then she goes on to say that, there she found out about a thing, the people that were working there, because they'd lost, some of their work, they weren't working as many hours, they could apply, and she got the grant, and that's how she got the money, and then kind of snaps at him at the end saying, you don't believe me, call FEMA, apparently they care more about me than you do. That's basically the scene. Sorry to rush through it, but I'm going to be referring to many bits of it. Now, I keep telling you all the time, I say one of the first things you have to do is just kind of divorce yourself from thinking that you're going to be playing the part. Just stand away from it and really act like you're a detective, like you're someone eavesdropping on a conversation. And from it, I'm going to ask you, hey, what'd you hear? What's going on there? So you have no acting participation as of yet. This is all analyzing. What is going on here? Because you see, what most actors will do, and it's what this woman I was working with started to do, of course, everyone does it, is you understand the concept. You've read the script. We're brother and sister. Obviously, you've been turned down many times. Now you've said you've got it. Apparently there's some money involved. And in fact, you didn't get it. And then, you have to finally admit it and then tell us about FEMA and this and that. Most people understand how to play that, right? You kind of halfway almost lie well, but you kind of don't because the actor always knows they're guilty, so they kind of don't tell a great lie, like a lie that would never float in real life. I can always tell when I'm working with them. I say, well, okay, I don't believe anything you're doing right now. I mean, you look like you're lying to me. You look like you're hiding something. And I'm always pointing out that, in real life, we're very good at this. And if we aren't, we should be for the sake of the cinema, because it's always more interesting. For instance, okay, girl lies, sister lies, sister gets caught. She didn't actually get the Guggenheim, she got a FEMA. Okay, there's that story. But where we take it up a notch, and where I think the actor really brings it, okay, really brings it, because, almost without an actor, if we just read that, if we just read that on paper, well, we would get what I just explained. Why would we need the actors? Well, we need the actors because the actors are going to come in, and hopefully, if they're a virtuoso, they're going to come in and they're going to put their own spin on it. You see, they're going to do something extra special with it. What is extra special? You know, usually for me, extra special mirrors what I see in life most of the time. And so now I want to break the scene down for you. Well, obviously, we have somebody who's been lying and got caught. Okay, but let's examine really what it is. And I started talking to her about this. I say, so you lied about getting a Guggenheim grant. Now, I want you to imagine in real life, and everyone listening, please, imagine having the balls to tell people you got a Guggenheim grant. Now, don't say, well, I'd have to be crazy, or, you know, okay, that would be a different type of person. No, you did it. You did it. How does that happen? Well, I guess to even be in that realm of someone that would even think these thoughts, I guess it's someone that spins in those circles, right? And since we know the brother has tried six times and they fancy themselves intellectuals, you travel in those circles. In your world, in getting a Guggenheim grant really, you know, kind of gets some points on the board for you. Just like getting a series, getting anything. That is your thing. Now, okay, so let's just take a step and understand that. Like in real life, though. I mean, come on, even in your life, whatever you do, I assume you're listening, so you're aspiring to be an actor. But if suddenly somehow you also worked it out where you got a Guggenheim grant, hey, that'd be a cool thing to drop at parties. Yeah, it's got this crazy Guggenheim grant thing. Gave me a bunch of money so I can do my thing. I mean, come on. You know, that is saying something about, like, the ability you have, right? I mean, that's, hopefully don't brag about it, but that's kind of what that would be. So in your world, that's important to you. Let's take it a step at a time. You apparently tried to get this grant eight times. Not only did you try to get the grant eight times, but no one knew about it, really, right? Because your brother finds out about it through doing investigation as a result of your name missing from a list that you're supposed to be on and aren't. And because of that, he finds out. So now let's just look at that for a second. This, to me, is how you work on a part, really, because you got to go through some basic steps with it. Forget your stupid beats and actions and all that other stuff, that dumb stuff that has nothing to do with human behavior. It's like, you know, little games, the acting games. Forget about all that nonsense. Let's really get to the meat and bones of what's going on with this thing. So let's just talk about that. You are someone who actually tried to get a Guggenheim grant eight times. Now, something tells me it's not like beer pong, where you walk up and you just, you know, you try and toss. If you get three in, you get the grant. I would imagine that this thing that you have to fill out and submit and do and whatever the process is, you know, there's a commitment involved. Imagine doing it and failing. And then you did it again. And then you thought, you know, I'm going to do it again. And he did it again. And you failed four times. But you know what you do? You do it again. And then you know what? You try again. And you failed six times. Oh, but that doesn't stop you. You do it seven. You do it eight. Now, right off the bat, a lot of people say, well, that's determination. Yeah, it could be. Or some kind of crazy fixation. Because keep in mind, you never tell your brother you're trying to do this. Now, you see, when I find out stuff like this about people, I start wondering about them. I say, what kind of person does that? You want to surprise people? Okay. I think if you, like, tried two times and got in, that would be a good surprise. Eight times? I don't know. I think you'd want to tell people about that. You want to commiserate with people about that. But no, you don't tell people about that. Your brother's tried six times. One of the other things that you say is you say, you guys never believed in me. You're just like him, meaning your father. Okay, you know, if I heard somebody talk about something like that, I'd wonder about the family dynamics. You guys have seen this, haven't you? It's probably happening to you. You might be one part of this dynamic. There is the golden child, and then there's the other child. And somehow the golden child can never do any wrong. And the other child, you know, is it's unfortunate you're never going to be the golden child. This happens in many families. There's this common dynamic. It's a weird thing, but it occurs. And they favor the one person. Why can't you be more like that person? And it goes on and on and on. So now imagine being in that situation. So now think about the fact you did it 8 times. Boy, wouldn't that be some cool, like, checkmate to be able to all of a sudden go, hey, by the way, I got a Guggenheim grant. Me, who apparently is not the golden child, who all you ever talk about is my brother, and you guys talk and act like I'm not even in the room with you. Well, guess what I did? I got the Guggenheim. Wouldn't that be beautiful? That might be a reason why you're trying 8 times and still haven't told anyone yet. You don't want to discuss your failures, only your successes. That makes sense, right? So here's a big question, and here's a question that I asked the woman I was working with. How did that happen? How did you suddenly tell someone you got a Guggenheim grant? Now, I like to ask these questions, and then I like to go through the script and try and find the answer, because you can generally always find it. In this particular script, he asks her, where did all the money come from? It feels like she got that FEMA money first. Because obviously she hadn't told her brother about that either. So she got the FEMA money first, and then suddenly she had a lot of money. So I said, so let's come up with a scenario. In real life, your life, the people, whoever is listening to this, don't imagine how other people, other slimy people who have no ethics or morals do things. No, how would you do it? So let's say that you're put upon in your family because you're always neglected. You work really hard. Hey, it's not easy to be rejected 8 times and keep going. That in itself deserves a medal. You hear about this other thing with FEMA. You get your money. The money comes in. And then I'm thinking, okay, how does this go down where you actually do it? Because when I'm talking to actors and I say, look, justify your point of view, you know, make sense out of why you would do something, I always feel that when I hear people's stories, the ones that are the most compelling are the ones where you kind of say, God, you know, I kind of see why you did that, what ends up being kind of a dumb thing, but I kind of see why you did it. I always enjoy this the most because I think it ends up being more interesting, more perplexing, more confounding for the audience when they see that. And generally, when they see it, they see themselves. And so, how did it happen? Could it have been that the brother and the sister and the dad were out eating somewhere? The sister has her FEMA money, so she's got plenty of money in the bank. Normally, she has none. Dad's always picking up the check. And they go on and on and on, talking about something like you're not even there. And you just decide, you know, your best way to throw down at this point is just to go bang, hey, I got the check. And you're at some fancy New York place. And they go, well, what? No, where are you getting the money? And then, you know what, it just comes out. You just say, I got the Guggenheim. It just, having had a couple of too many Chardonnays and all that money in your pocket and then blathering on and on, suddenly you just kind of puke it out, and there it is. And you see your dad completely change. What? And then you're in it now, and your dad's saying, I knew it. I always knew it. You see, that's why I gave you a hard time. And all this stuff happens, and your brother is shrinking like a violet, and you are paying, and if you had a cigar right then, you'd smoke it. Now what do you do? So now imagine being someone who not only did that, but now you'd have to live that. You'd play it down, but then your brother might be somewhere going, hey, yeah, did Shirley tell you she got a Guggenheim? Yeah, my sister. I mean, it's, yeah, she did. You know, what do you say? Your dad's interested. Yeah, she is. You know what I tell you? There's no chip off the old block right over here. I always used you to finally get it together. Yeah, we got Guggenheim. Yeah, that's right, Guggenheim. Oh, yeah, she got lots of money, Guggenheim. Now imagine that. Now imagine that has been your life. Now you being you, listening to this. One side of that, boy, it's a nice feeling kind of in a weird way, but then what's the downside? You imagine what would happen if everyone found out. You would be like a lunatic, right? I mean, in real life, like your life, if people actually found out that you had been going on, you'd be one of these people we read about. You'd be a punchline. You become a punchline. Everybody's like, oh my God, he pulled a Jeff. No, you don't want to be a punchline, right? You don't want it, but you're in it now. And to admit, even right afterwards, that's what you did, it would make you feel probably more pathetic about everything that you're fixating on that you're not. And this frustration you're feeling in the in your family with regards to the relationship you have with your father and your brother. Yeah? Okay, so now imagine that you come in and one of the first things your brother says to you is, hey, they printed a list in the paper and your name wasn't on it. Okay, at first, what's he talking about? Then he said, the Guggenheim. Now imagine in real life hearing that. So now I ask you, very simply, how would you like this to go? How does this need to go? If you could wave a wand, what would happen? That somehow we could get off the subject. See, actors are always wondering, like, what choice do I make? Got to make a strong choice, blah, 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 blah. But you see, if we're investigators and we understand really what's going on the scene, right? And then we can understand it to the point where we can play it out in our minds as if, okay, because the question I ask actors this all the time, how did it go down? Everyone stares at me like, what go down? How did you first tell a lie? When did you first utter it? Right? I mean, there was a point at which you said something. When, why, where? Now, in the scenario that I gave you, do you see how it almost feels like beautifully justified? Can you see how you would tell a friend, you'd say, if you could be honest with a friend, you'd say, you know, just sitting there, and they were just so smug, and they were acting like I wasn't even there, and I said, boom, and it was like $380 for the check, and I took it, and I said, I got it, and when they looked at me, I don't know what happened, I just blurted out the Guggenheim. And then the way they treated me, the way Dad looked at me, you know, see, to me, this is a really interesting choice, isn't it? But isn't it also like a real one? Isn't this how stuff happens? It just, that's how it happens. You know, when something crazy like this occurs, and then the great part is you have to now live it. And then, you see, now it's very easy for you to understand what happens when that whole thing is threatened. Oh, my God, you don't want that at all. So what do? You protect your lie like a fierce, wounded animal. You have got to get this person off it. You got to shut this line of questioning down. You got to make sure they understand that's not what's going on. You got to move on. That's what you have to do. And then what we also get a little insight to is the human animal and what we will do to try and get out of a situation. Because, as I always say, it's hard to be Gandhi. So now I want you to think about it. If I started a line of questioning, what would you do? If you honestly wanted to get out of the situation and could divorce yourself from where this scene is going, you would hope that when you first uttered, oh, well, must have been an oversight, when you first said that line, that your brother would somehow accept it. And that when you started saying, you know, you're policing me, that's sick, that he would suddenly cower and feel a little bad that he doubted you. And you would say, you know, you and Dad, you never believed in me. That's, you know, you would turn this around and try and get him to feel so guilty that you kind of toss him off the trail. The actor always wants to kind of ultimately be playing where it's going. But what's going to be more fascinating is how vehemently you protect your point of view and your side. That's what makes it so confounding when we watch it as the viewer. When he finally grills her and says, you know, look, where did you get it? Because now she has to accept the fact that he does have the goods on her because he has an inside person in the Guggenheim. He's looked it up on the computer. She's been turned down 8 times. He presses it. She realizes she's got nowhere else to go. So what does she do? She now says these lines. She says, okay, whatever. I got a grant. It wasn't a Guggenheim. Big effing deal. I got it somewhere else. It's a different grant. Now, what does that tell me? That tells me that now that she has to kind of go to a second position and lay off the Guggenheim thing, she is going to now, you know, double down and say it was a different grant. So what? Now, what's interesting is in the script, and I want to see how many actors fall for this. The brother says, what kind of grant? What? You said it was a different kind of grant. What kind of grant was it? And the sister, there's a little stage direction, and it says, weekly. And the sister says, FEMA. And he says, FEMA? FEMA? What's FEMA? Federal emergency? And then we go off on that. I always say the actor, really. So a second ago, you're basically, you know, barking at me. Basically, you're trying to get me to back down. You're telling me, look, so what? It was another one. Big deal. Big effing deal. It's another thing. I got another grant. Why then on the next line are you going to weakly say, FEMA? Like it's a little joke. Like it's a joke. That's how you write a joke, you know. That's how a joke's written. Big, loud, blah, blah, and then FEMA. And then we realize that's it. But you know what I don't like about that? It's a joke. It's a written joke. I've seen people in the midst of all of this doing this kind of thing, boy, and they just do not back down. And a lot of the time you leave the situation and you can't remember, you know, what you were there trying to do or, you know, if you're wrong now and you start questioning everything. That is the real fierce manipulation that goes on in life. And, you know, when you do that stuff on stage or in front of the camera, it is fascinating to watch because now we not only have what the outcome was, you know, oh, well, the sister never really got a Guggenheim thing, but we also get to marvel at human, the human condition and what we do. Oh, my goodness. So I always tell you know, look, if just there you're saying it with pride, what big effing deal, what difference does it make? Then bark it. You say FEMA. I said, FEMA, federal, yeah, that's right. What have you got? All you've got is to be able to now, in desperation almost, but fierce desperation, stand up for it anyway. Because you see, if you immediately knuckle under, then you just look like the guilty little kind of piece of shit party that you are. As opposed to, you still are somehow going to win it. And look how you end it. She says, FEMA, look, if you don't believe me, just call them, because obviously they care more about me than you do. To the very end, this character is trying to turn this around, make her brother feel bad and saying, you know, talk to FEMA. FEMA cares about me more than you do. What an interesting thing. We went from her being a liar about a Guggenheim grant to now turning it around to where the brother should feel bad because FEMA apparently cares about her more than he does. It is what most actors would call a multi-layered scene. Not just about realizing the truth in a lie, but actually showing us a fascinating array of complications with this particular character and what she did and why she might have done it and what the relationship is and the pressure she must feel in her family to think that she needed to do something like this and on and on and on. And where does it come from? Where does all this magnificent layering come from? It comes from understanding scenes in a more thorough, honest, and authentic way. And so, the best way to be this intriguing is to learn to identify the complexities of life's issues. And that isn't hard to do because we confront them all the time in our friends' lives and our lives. You know, these simple problems we have are generally complex issues. In this particular situation, it all starts with, when did you do it? You see, because once you understand why you did it, look, you don't have to write any of this down. I mean, I'm sure that everything I just said in this podcast, you remember. This is a myth that you're going to forget it or you need to go back and reread it. No, you don't. You can remember it again. You can just go, oh, memory, come back. Oh, there it is. Yeah, you did it. It's in your own personal iCloud. You don't write everything down that's on your iCloud, right? Because that's a lot of writing. You'll remember this. You see, but you need to go through it. You need to think beyond the way actors think about things, because it's always very limited and two-dimensional. I get angry here, I'll bang my fist there, and I'm going to play a really interesting opposite. No. We want to be these forensic actors that get in there and listen to the dialogue and look around and figure out what happened, where was this point of ignition, where are we now, and if I were this person, really honestly, not knowing the end of the script, what would I like to have happen? Do you kind of see how, with the information I've given you, imagine that dinner, how it went down, what your family dynamic is, and what this particular scene's about. Now, I want you to think about it. Doesn't it seem like with the information you have now, it would be kind of fun just to have at it? Can you see how with the information I've given you now, that to break it into beats or to plan with action verbs or anything, can you see how superfluous and stupid that would be now? How unfun. How unfun that would be. To now what? Plan it all out? You know, it's funny. The very thing that we want to do, we want to be spontaneous. I mean, that's what everyone's after, right? Spontaneous acting, spontaneity, right? That's what we all want. Yet, people still approach acting in a way that very clearly defines what they're going to be doing, in as much as they use beats and action verbs and play an opposite on this line and a lot of pre-planning, this old school pre-planning. You know, all of that is always going to keep you from being able to be spontaneous, right? My theory is that what you want to do is kind of the opposite. You want as little to hamper your spontaneous performance as possible. You have the lines, they have to be said, okay? They have to go the way they're written, you have to say them. As far as the planning goes, aside from what I have told you, this information, that dinner, the dynamic, I mean, don't you see how you could kind of handle anything now? Do you understand? I mean, I could change the scene on you. We could change the dialogue in the scene on its feet. But with the information you have, the position you're playing from, don't you feel confident that you could pretty much do whatever and it's all going to be right because you understand the core idea of what's happening? You know what happened. And you have a very justifiable side. You see, and this is another key ingredient. It's very important because it's what gives you so much strength in your work. And in life, this is how it's done. We find that justifiable angle. That's how we argue why we were correct. That's how we argue why we weren't so bad when we did the thing. With that knowledge now, you see, you're really ready for anything, man. And then suddenly you can see how just superfluous and silly it would be to now, in the context of this knowledge and ability, think, oh, I better plan it out in here. I'm going to do that. And then I'll sit and I'll kind of go on that line. And then I'll look up. And now I'd like to bring it back to what my Aussie friend commented on. And that idea that, you know, I didn't really feel angry. And I said, yeah, well, you know what would be ideal is if between action and cut, you could actually get angry. So that, this little trick right here that I'm going to touch on, combined with finding the true spine, the true moment of ignition, the quality piece of information that you need that'll set everything else on fire, send you on your way, and, you know, make you the type of actor you want to be, this thing you couple with that, and it's simply this. As far as getting angry, as far as doing anything, you really need to remember this and never forget it and trust this is the way you go because it's the only way it works. You can behave however you want at any given moment simply because you decide. In life, the things we say make us mad don't actually make us mad. They make us mad because we decide to be mad about them. I've mentioned this many times. You know, Bob did that thing and he really made me angry. No, Bob did a thing and you chose to be angry about it. Whether or not it would be justifiable in court or not, it is a choice we make. You have the ability to decide these things. So here's one of the little slippery aspects of being a really fine actor, and that is mastering that. You master it by knowing that you can make a decision and then you do it, and you start executing it that way. Stop, you know, don't put your thumb on the pulse of whether or not it's happening for real. Am I doing it? Am I feeling it? Am I? Because in life, we don't do that. We step off and we pursue what we stepped off about. That's it. And you want to master that. And you master it by simply doing it, you see. And this is why I'm so against conventional acting, where one is told, well, you know, you substitute, you do this, you think three things, you try a double that, and you do a, you know, opposite this, and that's how you... Every time you start to use this type of thinking, this type of technique, what you're saying is where I'm trying to do, where I'm trying to be, what I'm trying to attain is hard. It's so hard that I have to use all this other stuff to do it, as opposed to what I'm offering, which is you are the master of you. You get to decide what's on the menu. You decide whether something bothers you or not. And if you make that decision, you pursue it. You'll get used to that. And soon you'll really, really be good at it. But that, ladies and gentlemen, is how it's done. That's the way we do it in life. Okay, in wrapping, listen, you've got to start losing this old mechanics of acting and planning and beat making and doing that. That's just scaredy cat work. You know what that's like? That's just like painting by the numbers. You know, the paint by the numbers paintings? That's a perfect analogy, really. Because you're going to plan out little things and, you know, you're going to pretend like, oh, I just throw it all away and then it magically happens. But it doesn't. You're there. You're having to pull every lever and make sure everything occurs the way you planned your performance. And you go up here and down there and do this here and do that there. And it's like painting by the numbers. You don't want to be a professional paint by the numbers artist. Because you know what the deal is, right? At about 50 feet, it's magnificent. You go, whoo, look at that. It's a sailboat. Until you get up close, and then suddenly it's WTF. You want to avoid that. All right. That's today's podcast. I hope that it was insightful for you, and I hope you got something out of it. I'm going to be in Toronto. It's coming up. My first night of classes will be April 2nd, 7 o'clock, and I'll be doing two classes a day. From 4 to 6:30 and 7 to 10, most every day I'm there through the 14th of April. So if you're in Toronto, you can come by and audit a class, or you can contact me and you can sign up. I hope to see you there. It's going to be a great group of people. All right, everyone. Thanks for listening. You have been listening to a Real Life Actor podcast. This is Jeff Seymour. Real Life Actor podcasts can be found on Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, and Podomatic. Please tell your friends. And if you're in the Los Angeles area and you'd like to audit one of my classes, send me an email at jeff@realifeactor.com. Thanks for listening.